This is very informal, and I guess some of you, well, Yasemin, you have already seen some version of, well, I mean, you've been in the room when this theory came about, the dark matter, and you did mention it. So the plan of this meeting for the first 4 days was to talk about the outstanding issues with dark energy and how causal sets can be used as a way to explain it or understand these outstanding issues. So the idea for the last day was anything in cosmology other than dark energy that we could think about as ways of probing or understanding causal sets. And the one that we have particularly worked on is dark matter. So, and there aren't that many people who have worked on it. So Sumati suggested that I talked about it, and I don't think I've ever talked about it. So I decided to just do that. Yeah. Oh yeah, sorry, I gave it away. It was supposed to be animation. So it's dark matter from quantum gravity. It's original work by Siavash, Aslan Beg and Mehdi. I meant to put their pictures here, but can't focus on. And they're both rich bankers now, so they're...
profited from dark matter.
That's right. I'm sure it was because of the dark matter. So, but then they kind of left me behind to defend off, to promote the theory, and they just out there making money. So I find that very selfish to be. So I guess at least if you...
Mehdi has also joined...
Yeah. So he's in Goldman Sachs in London.
Okay.
Yeah. And Siavash is in BMO at Bank of Montreal in Toronto. So at least the last that I've heard about them. So yeah, so there, I think it's you need to, if you make a theory, you have to kind of defend it and stick around and promote it. it's like your children, right? So, but anyway, so I'm gonna try to do my best. But I mean, it would be good if Rafael was around because he would be able to answer some questions. And in any case, so this talk will be recorded. So hopefully, if someone wants to learn how dark matter can come from quantum gravity, they could refer back to this talk. Any questions? So let's get it started. These are basically the three papers that Mehdi, this is the thing that Mehdi Saravani has been kind of spearheading, and Siavash before he left the field, or he got his PhD and went into banking, he worked on. So the idea is that dark matter can come from non-locality of a space-time, and in particular from causal set models, although non-locality is in no means unique to causal set proposal. It kind of comes out naturally in causal set, but I mean, in principle, anybody who works on quantum gravity believes that there is, in some way, quantum gravity must be a non-local theory. Although the way this in which it's non-local, different people disagree on. So what Siavash and Mehdi had done was developed a minimal framework to describe this non-locality. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but not too much. And then they proposed that, in fact, dark matter would be something that would naturally emerge in that framework. So this was the paper that we did before Mehdi graduated. That was more than 3 years ago. And he wrote, I think, a review of it recently. I'm not exactly sure why he wrote it, because I think it was just reviewing the work he'd done before. I want to say maybe he wanted to, what is it called? When you wrap something up, I'm not sure, like a parting shot.
It's not published, is it?
It's on archive. I'm not sure whether where he's submitted it. Maybe you saw him last in London. Did he say something about this?
Just that it's my last contribution.
Yeah. I think he wanted to kind of put his last thoughts on physics on archive, and then be done with it. So I can certainly see there's a lot of sentimental value to that. I'm not planning to do that anytime soon. Anyway, so you could find out more about this here. So let's get it started. So what's the main idea? So the main idea that Siavash and Mehdi came up with, and this kind of developed over time in our group meetings that some of you have been to, some of you have graduated from. So the main idea has had to do with whether you can define a unitary non-local field theory. And they tried to be very rigorous about it, but it turned out that at the end, when they tried to be very rigorous about the definitions and what quantum mechanics of this theory means, it looks like it can be thought of as if your regular field theory is a particle of mass m, the non-locality, what it does is that it adds to the theory a bunch of massive states, in fact, a continuum of massive modes with mass higher than m, basically. And these are called off-shell modes, or at least that's what they call them. Of course, the off-shell is somewhat different from what in quantum field theory you call off-shell. So off-shell because in quantum field theory, when you talk about off-shell particles, these are virtual particles in your interactions. Here, these are off-shell particles that could exist. Hello, hey, welcome. Good. So these off-shell particles are particles that don't satisfy are not on shell. That means that their momentum squared is not their mass squared. That's the definition of being on shell. But nevertheless, they could exist forever. So in fact, that's the idea, because the idea that these will be dark matter.
Sorry, can you repeat what you define as off-shell?
So on-shell is something that satisfies the dispersion relation or the shell relation, which is basically the square of the momentum is mass squared. This capital M is the mass of your particle or your field. And that would be on-shell. And particles that don't satisfy that, they would be called off-shell. But in regular quantum field theory, those do actually only exist in loops in Feynman diagrams. They don't exist outside the interactions. They don't live forever. They don't go out of the interactions or into interactions. However, in this case, these off-shell particles can live forever. And that's the special property of non-locality.
So you can have an open leg with...
That's right, exactly. You can have an open leg, exactly, right? So you could have some Feynman diagram, right? Like this, for example. And usually, these guys can have any momentum, so are not on shell. So for these guys, PS squared is not MS squared. But for these guys, PS squared is MS squared. So however, if you have a non-local theory, the idea is that this is violent. So here, for the guys that go out or in, also P squared doesn't have to be x. So that's the idea.
External legs can be off-shell.
External legs exactly can be off-shell. Now, the magical property of these, or at least magical sounding property of these off-shell modes is that the transition rate of any scattering, including one or more of these off-shell modes, in the initial state, and initial state is a keyword here, is zero. So it means that essentially they have zero interaction, these off-shell particles. Now, the weird thing is that you can actually produce them, but then when you produce them, then they stop interacting with anything. And it sounds contradictory, but that's the key idea, and I'm gonna explain in a minute what that means. Because they don't interact with anything, at least, in a non-gravitational way, you think that they could be a good model for dark matter, because dark matter we don't see and we don't detect it. So if you could produce these guys in the early universe somehow and then they stop interacting with anything, that just fits the bill for dark matter. So that's why Mehdi and Siavash were excited in terms of basically this being a candidate for dark matter. Now, why is this not as magical as it sounds? It's just kind of a trick of hands with the phase space volume or phase space factor. So the idea is that if you have n species of particles, which have some coupling to a standard model, now if you let the number of species go to infinity, but the coupling go to zero, what happens is you could actually tune the product of the number of species times the coupling with the right power so that you could always produce particles, right? So that the rate of producing any particular species becomes small when the coupling goes to zero. But if you have many and many more species, then the rate of producing all of them could remain constant. So you let the coupling go to zero, but the number of species go to infinity in a way that when you produce these species from some interaction, the rate remains finite. But the reverse is not true. So if you have any particular particle of any given species, because the coupling is zero, then that it doesn't interact with anything. So this is basically the way to understand it. Of course, that's not the way they get at it, but this is a simple way to understand what this continuum does. Its coupling is very, very small, but there are many, many of these modes, and the way this kind of these two factors interact with each other or play together is that these optional modes don't interact with anything, but you could produce them. So, and this is a unitary. It turns out it's a unitary theory. It's just a particular limit of a unitary theory. Okay? Any questions? So this is the key idea, basically, the key theoretical idea, which it does, and the reason it, I'm not going to talk much more about non-locality, but the reason it's related to non-locality is that you could always think about, yes?
Just this argument. Are you saying that if you simply did this in any regular field theory as well?
Yeah, no, so but usually regular field theories, you have a finite number of species in it, right?
Yeah, but here, why is it you're saying non-locality gives rise to this?
Right, so the idea is that non-locality, you could think of it as having a branch cut in your propagators. And this one, I don't feel too confident, but the idea is basically, if you think about in the momentum space, this is a real part of momentum, an imaginary part. So usually when you think about, this is your propagator, if you just have a regular field theory, you just have a pole, right? You just have two poles. And this would be like 1 over p squared plus m squared plus I epsilon. So the pole, this is just off the real axis. In a non-local theory, you replace this by some other function of momentum. Right? So this goes to some 1 over b of p. And the idea is that then you could think about this as instead of having a single simple pole, you would have a branch cut along this axis. And this branch cut, you can think of it, the idea of having a lot of particles, that this branch cut, you can think about it as a lot of poles, like very close by poles.
So for every point you're assigning.
That's right. So it's, you're approximating this branch cut as a lot of poles. But it turns out if you work out if you just take a standard field theory interactions, the coupling of every individual pole to the rest of the field theory would be zero, but there are infinitely many of these poles, and that's kind of responsible for this behavior.
And so, now you're saying, suppose you took, in regular field theory, if you took infinite number of species
yeah.
to zero, then you would get a similar situation.
You get a similar situation, yep. But you have to take the limit in the right way to get that situation.
Is there something like is this a theorem?
Well, no, I think they just, trying to remember, did they prove it? How rigorously they prove this? I think there is a derivation of this. Yeah. And I'm trying to remember, I think there's an integral that you could approximate as a sum. And so that's kind of what it is. So there's an it.
So you will produce these quote unquote off shell modes.
That's right.
Which are non interacting.
Well, they are, for any finite number of species, they are interacting, but then as the limit that goes to infinity, the interaction goes to zero.
And because you also have this coupling going to zero, mm-hmm. produced, but.
Mm-hmm.
Then the produce, there's a non
yeah.
Transition
right.
Production.
That's right.
Once they produce, they don't introduce.
That's right.
It's true even in this, okay.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm going to come back to this point if there is time, that they don't interact in a regular way, that if you compute a scattering matrix or scattering cross-section between any off-shell mode and any on-shell particle or off-shell particle, it's going to be zero. But there could be more complicated interactions that are not zero. For example, we know that if they have energy, they must gravitate, right? So they must have gravitational scattering in some way. But you cannot think of gravitational scattering as a single particle. But probably you have a coherent superposition of these guys that interact in some way. So there must be some caveat to this statement. The gravity is certainly a caveat. If there is that, there might be other caveats as well. It just hasn't been explored.
What's the caveat that you almost just stated? Even without gravity, if you imagine two of these particles being produced in a collision of on-shell particles,
yeah.
Then it should be possible somehow to time reverse
that's right.
Final state and go back to two on-shell particles.
Mm-hmm.
But that final state is some complicated superposition of
that's right, yeah.
Involving infinite numbers.
So you have a coherent, you need a coherent superposition of this to actually do this. Yeah.
But then it is a unitary process somehow.
It is a unitary process, yeah.
Can you remind, how does one see the non-locality from this second point of view where you have an infinite number of...
Right. No, I think that has to do with what I said is that, and this I don't remember, but there's a good reason that for a general B of PP, there must be a branch cut along the real axis.
That's right.
And then you could always think about... So that's just non-locality. You said that if you have a generic function, it would have a branch cut. Right. And
then this is not just a finite number of...
And then the finite number is that you approximate this branch cut as a bunch of poles. So that's where it comes.
Right, but I mean, this function of P is not just a finite number of derivatives. So in that sense, it's non-local. Is that
that's right, exactly. Exactly, yeah, yeah.
The point is that if this was true, you didn't have to have it non-local. If you had a branch cut, but if it is non-local, it definitely does have a branch cut.
Oh, you think even if you
hit? I mean,
I thought we were sort of saying if there's a branch cut, it is not local. Is that not?
Yeah, I think that's the idea. And
I've just seen the other way around. The branch cut exists. I don't know that it's always true that if you had a branch cut, it would be a.
So that's kind of what I'm asking. But
okay,
I think
so you're asking whether the existence of a branch cut implies non-locality. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit. I think all theories have a branch cut there, all interacting theories. So I don't think just having a branch cut means a non-local theory. It just comes from multi-particle states and things like that.
This is a single, a free...
Right, but less, so that's the thing. So I'm saying just interactions themselves give you a branch cut.
Yeah.
And if you're just talking about the propagator as some observable, then you don't know what it means the free for it to be free or interacting. So you could think about it as like interactions themselves give you non-locality, which I think it's a reasonable point of view. That's another point. So yeah, I think this is if you could describe things at the finite number of poles, then it's the finite number of species. But then if there is a branch cut, there might be still a local description. Right? I don't think one it goes one way. But if it's non-local, there certainly should be a branch cut. It's just because, actually, even that I don't know. But I've just stated that. So.
Must be true.
Must be true. Okay. So, but we're going to use this the fact that there is a branch. Okay, so this is the idea. So it's not magic. It's just your particular limit of field theory where you have a lot of species.
So thanks. That was really useful.
And also, the fact that you say the coupling goes to zero is not magical, because you imagine there's some quantum gravity effect, there should be all Planck suppressed. So you do imagine, if you're thinking about some effect related to discreteness of a space-time, and you're talking about low-energy processes, it does make sense to kind of think about the coupling going to zero, although I think there are some qualifiers to that statement. But the idea of coupling going to zero is just really has to do with the fact that when you are, if these have to do with like Planck scale processes, there must be Planck suppressed, at least heuristically, and that's why coupling should go to zero.
I guess it doesn't tell us where the infinite number of species comes
from. Yeah, the infinite number of species, I think it's more subtle, and it's a very good question of why. I guess maybe one way to think about it is that if you think there are like bounded states of gravitons to your particle, I don't know, something like that. Yeah.
GNs of all different topologies.
Yeah.
The number of those is right.
I guess it's just thinking that if you have a particle of mass m, you could have kind of very light particles that are bound to it, and there could be a continuum of those, I suppose. So I don't know, that's one way to think about it. But I think basically the main idea would be that because you have light degrees of freedom in your theory, i.e. graviton, that could give you a continuum of states. If you only had heavy particles in your theory, then probably this wouldn't happen. So anyway, that's the guess. Okay, so now just a couple of formulas. So the main way that calculations goes, and I don't remember these very well, and I mean Mehdi did all of these anyway, so I'm not sure if I even understood it at the time very well. But the main idea is that you try to do this compute. Basically, you write Feynman diagrams, and these are just tree diagrams. So for example, here is the decay of so if you have some cross section or some decay process, but you produce one off-shell particle, and I guess we call it F for off-shell and O for on-shell. I'm not sure. It doesn't make sense. I don't know why we did it, but yeah. So this F is off-shell and O is on-shell. So the idea is that now let's say you're producing two particles here.
First initially you would have O and O.
So it would have been OF and ON. So then you would think that if you say, okay, you get rid of the O, there would be F divided by N. But anyway, so because the O's would cancel. Right. So the idea, but anyway, so the idea here is, let's say this is some process that you could produce some on-shell particle here. Let's call it capital N. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. Or you could produce some off-shell particle. So this is the red is the off-shell, white is the on-shell. It turns out that you could actually compute. Now, the process itself might be complicated, but if you're only interested in the ratio of the rates for this, the red producing red particle versus the white particle, everything in the process is the same except for this vertex. And if you can basically compute that without knowing exactly what's happening inside this Feynman diagram. And what it does depend on is what appears in that vertex, which depends on the imaginary part of B. So this W tilde is the ratio of twice the imaginary part of B divided by BPS squared. And B was, if you remember, was this thing. Was this box operator, whatever replaces your Lambertian or your propagator. And the imaginary part of B is basically this discontinuity across this branch chart. So that's why you need the branch cut. If there is no, of course, if the branch cut wasn't there or this imaginary part was zero, then this rate would be zero as well. So the branch cut actually tells you whether these particles exist or how much of them. I guess it tells you. I'm not quite sure what is the right I guess it gives you the residue of the pole. So that's what this imaginary part is.
And I mean, so in other words, that without the branch cut, the imaginary thing would always be zero.
Yeah.
So the branch cut is essential for.
That's right. So if the branch cut is there, then you get these off-shell modes, right?
Okay.
And the amplitude of making them or the rate of making them is proportional to the discontinuity at the branch cut. Okay. So this imaginary part of B is the discontinuity across the branch. So let's see what else. So this ratio, so this just comes from computing this the Feynman diagram. It involves integrating over the momenta of, I think, ingoing particles. I'm just trying to remember how these work. So Q is the incoming energy momentum, and P1 and P2, I don't remember what they are. I think P2, here, I guess the idea is that you...
I would think they would be outgoing.
They would be outgoing. If Q is ingoing, then P1 and P2 would be outgoing. And I think P1 here is, okay, good. So you can see P1 is on shell because you have delta P1 squared, but P2 is here is off shell, so you have W tilde here, but here is on shell. So I think the idea here is you're producing one on shell particle and one off shell particle.
So you're integrating over the P1
and P2, right? So because you're basically it's producing over all possible on-shell and off-shell particles. So this is outgoing final phase space. So an amplitude would just be this combination.
Delta plus, what is?
So delta plus is just delta, but it's only non-vanishing for positive energy rather than, yeah. So I think delta plus is just delta of P squared times delta of P zero.
So theta.
Theta of P0, not delta, yes. Times theta of P0. So it's only, it's not vanishing only for positive energies. Okay, so now this.
Is this a mass? There's no mass in it. Is this the massless?
This is for the massless limit. So a limit that, this is the limit of energy of central mass is much bigger than the mass of the particle. So the mass drops out because, exactly. Otherwise you would have a mass squared here. But this is a simpler limit here, and we are assuming that. Okay, so the next question to actually do this is to assume something for B. So again, in this massless limit, B would be just P squared or Q squared, which is what I have here up to the minus sign. But then there would be higher order corrections because of non-locality effects. So you're just expanding whatever your denominator is in your propagator in powers of momentum.
So what is lambda?
So lambda would be some high energy non-locality scale.
Okay.
So lambda is the scale.
Okay, so that will be in the form of B of B.
That's right. So the idea is that the below with energies below lambda, the non-locality is suppressed by energy divided by lambda, or Q squared over lambda squared. So it's just from pure analyticity, you expect. Basically, you expect to have Q squared at low energies. Q squared is just a saying that you have a massless particle. You expect this to be Q squared. But the non-locality effects, from analyticity, you expect this to go as Q to the fourth or higher power. And then the imaginary part, you assume that it starts only at 1 over lambda squared because you assume that you have a stable particle at low energies, so you don't. The imaginary part wouldn't have a Q squared bit. For a stable particle, there wouldn't be an imaginary part at low energies. So, and then the coefficient here, I just set it I defined lambda so that this coefficient is 1/2. Okay. So now, if you just plug this in these equations, you get this ratio of decay into off-shell to on-shell particles. Going as energy and center of mass energy divided by this cutoff energy to the square, or to the second power. So, and again, this is not that surprising either. It just says that you get something like this, say, from Fermi four-point interactions. Like, if you have some cutoff scale in your theory, like, for example, for neutrinos, the cutoff scale is W and Z boson. All the interactions that neutrinos are involved with, they are suppressed by a power like this. Now, the exact, whether it's 2 or 4 depends on exactly on interaction, but actually I think Yasima would know this. The neutrino interaction cross section was as energy over lambda squared. I think you wrote a paper on this or something related to this. So this is actually very similar to what you get in effective field theories. And in fact, actually, I think it's very similar to what you get for electroweak. If your lambda was, I think it's a W or Z bath.
What do you mean it's the same thing?
So it's basically the idea is that whenever you have a cutoff in your theory, then your interactions due to that cutoff are suppressed by powers of that cutoff. But that's, yeah. And
I mean the form of it.
The form of it, that's right. So you should really, you could really think of this as some version of effective field theory. So this non-locality, at least there is a way of thinking about it as an effective field theory. Of course, the part that's different from effective field theory is that you have infinitely many species. Usually in effective field theory, you have a finite number. Okay, so what do we do with this? So the nice thing about this is that now you could use this to compute what you expect for production or detection of these off-shell particles. For production of off-shell particles, the main idea here is that if you say this lambda is M Planck and the energies that you have access to are much lower than M Planck, then you're not going to produce these particles very easily. So this is basic. If you want next step for LHC, for example, how much off-shell, when you look at collision of hadrons, because LHC is a large hadron collider, how much off-shell particles is going to be produced? Well, if you say lambda is of order M Planck, 10 to the 18 GeV, LHC energy is a TeV, so that's 10 to the minus 15 squared, that would be 10 to the minus 30. So every 10 to the 30 particles that's produced in LHC, there would be one off-shell particle. Or for every 10 to the 30 on-shell particle, there would be one off-shell particle. That's so not that many. Actually, I don't know how many particles LHC has produced, but maybe it's not 10 to the 30?
No.
Maybe it is. How many particles has LHC produced?
You said off-shell particles.
I said for every 10 to the 30 on-shell.
So you're looking at the ratio, and so you're trying to see whether
that's right.
One.
Yeah, it hasn't produced one off-shell. But anyway, so it's going to be very hard to see this. If you're looking for missing energy, for example. So that's how people are looking for dark matter, for example, now in LHC. By looking at missing energy, that you have some interaction that you see things go in, but then things that come out, if you add up the energy and momentum of them, are they equal to the energy and momentum of things that go in? And that would be a way to find them. It's not going to be easy for these guys.
So this, none of this refers to the nature of the field, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be
right.
The field.
Right. Well, I'm going to come back to this. So, but all the calculations are done for a scalar field.
Right, because I mean, coming from both sets, we know what that
means. Yeah.
In general, this argument so far doesn't need the scalar field, right? It could be for any of the
right.
Standard.
I think that the sticky issue that we've talked about a lot, and I don't think we ever really got a good answer to, is that what to do with gauge theories. Or in a non-local description. Is there a good way to deal with gauge theories? And I think that's the open issue right now. And I mean, we know Stan models the gauge theory, so the question is, is it that the gauge theories are only approximate emergent symmetries at fundamental level that don't exist? Maybe that's one possibility. Or another is maybe there is a way to put non-locality in this BFP. But right now, I think that's one of the outstanding questions. I'm going to mention that at the end. OK, so now that we have this framework, which is pretty simple, can we do some phenomenology with it? And the first step is, okay, so what is the mass of these? This is a pretty simple result that Mehdi found, is you could compute the mass distribution of these guys, because, of course, they could have any mass, but you have a particular interaction. So here, the idea is that if you have some process, like I mentioned, and you produce one off-shell particle, only a single off-shell particle, everything else is on-shell. You could do this calculation using basically the amplitude of this, the rate of this diagram for different off-shell masses, and you find the distribution of masses for a particular center of mass energy. Now, of course, mass cannot be bigger than the center of mass energy. That's because of energy conservation. But you would find a distribution which peaks around 0.6 times the center of mass energy. So if you have some process, some high energy process, in which you produce an off-shell particle, the typical mass of that off-shell particle would be around 0.6 times the center mass energy, although it could be much smaller or much bigger. So this is an interesting kind of bit of phenomenology that will become important later. So actually, that one thing you conclude from this, of course, the higher the energy of the process, the higher is the mass of the particle. You all can already see, if you combine this fact with the fact that the production rate goes as energy divided by lambda squared, this is the kind of thing that we produce in the early universe, because that's when the universe was the hottest. You had the highest interaction energies. And the kind of particles that we're going to produce are going to be heavy, because that's when energies are the highest. So the typical mass of the particles you produce is the typical interaction energy, or central mass energy. So it kind of fits the bill for dark matter as well. So you produce it in the early universe, it would have very little interaction, and you cannot produce it anymore right now, because energies are much lower. And the fact that the mass is big is also good, because we know dark matter is cold. So I'm going to come back to that. So of course, energy, as those of you who know me, they know that inflation is not my favorite theory of the early universe. But nevertheless, that's the most popular theory, and we have a way of producing this dark matter, this off-shell dark matter in inflation. So very simple. At the end of inflation, you have a potential, a field that's oscillating around the minimum of its potential with some mass m. And in most inflation models, that's what happens. There's a mass which is basically curvature of the potential at the bottom, at its bottom at the end of inflation. What this formula tells you is that the ratio of mass that goes to off-shell particles to on-shell particles given by the mass m phi, which would be energy of every inflaton particle, would have energy of m phi. So if it decays into a star model particles or regular on-shell particles, or it could also decay to off-shell particles, that the ratio is given by this factor. Okay. So the ratio of a dark matter, because remember now we say off-shell particles are dark matter. The ratio of density of dark matter to ordinary matter at the end of inflation will be, or when this guy decays, is going to be m phi over lambda squared divided by 4 pi, which is going to be much less than 1 if lambda is, say, of order m Planck. And m phi is the mass of inflaton that has a large range. It could be as big as 10 to the 13 GeV, it could be much smaller. Okay, the interesting thing about this fraction is that it actually fixes the temperature of reheating when inflaton would decay to radiation. Because, and the way you could understand this is, let's see. Maybe I can draw a plot that shows this. So this is a very simple formula. So if f was 1, what happens in 0.7, what's in the numerator is 0.75 electron volts, which is the temperature at the quality. That's the temperature of the CMB when we have the same amount of dark matter and radiation in the universe. So the way to understand that formula is that if you have the density of, inflation, let's say T inflation. So I guess the temperature is decreasing this way, this direction. And this would be T reheating. And there would be T equality here, which is 0.75 electrons. Okay? So the density goes as a density of radiation goes as T to the fourth. So that would be from equality, it goes as, so at equality, you have the same amount of dark matter. So rho radiation over rho dark matter, it's one. Okay. Actually, let's try to draw this, rho dark radiation divided rho dark matter. So if you go below, before equality, this ratio gets bigger, and it increases like temperature. So this is proportional to temperature. This at the end of inflation, now between end of inflation and reheating, the idea is that you have, and this is somewhat model dependent, but it turns out for a large number of models, what you have is that you have these inflatons that are just hanging out there, and they're massive particles, so they act like dark matter. So what happens during that time is, I'm trying to remember what I should write here. I'm missing something here.
Last stage.
All right, so this is T equality, right? This is T equality. This is when radiation, when this ratio is one.
Oh, okay.
So the idea here is that this ratio is one here, and it grows with T. So at the time of reheating, this ratio, rho radiation, divided by rho dark matter should be T reheat divided by T equality. Okay? And then you were saying that at the end of inflation, the ratio of dark matter to radiation is F. So this should be 1 over F. Now, you may wonder what happens between here and here, but the idea is that basically the ratio of, that part, I think it doesn't make too much of a difference. And right now, I cannot articulate this very well. But if you think about it, actually, maybe the way to think about it is that you forget about this. Let's say there is a time of reheating, and at the time of reheating, the ratio of rho dark matter divided by rho radiation is 1 over F. Right, which is that formula. And then if you just look at this plot, the ratio of rho radiation by rho dark matter is given by T reheat divided by T equality. So that's just inverse.
Isn't that sort of the whole point of inflation? You can ignore, at least for this kind of purpose, you can ignore that regime.
It is not the whole point. That regime could...
It's supposed to also produce the fluctuations, but that's a
right.
Difference.
No, I think actually... but reheat temperature is very important because it does change the predictions of inflation.
No, I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
You can ignore what happened before the reheat.
Right. No, you cannot. It does, because the number of e-foldings of inflation depends on basically what happens here.
Yes.
Yeah.
But does that influence the matter content of the...
It influences the power spectrum, but
yeah. That's some e-folding.
Right.
These tiny fluctuations, but I don't know that it would influence the ratio of dark, what you're interested in here, the ratio of the dark matter.
Right.
The radiation period.
Yeah, so it could. I think it could. But I think for the simplest model that we consider, it didn't. Basically, the reason it doesn't is the idea is that your on-shell particles are inflatons at the end. Or some massive particles like inflaton, and your off-shell particles are your dark matter, but the ratio remains constant because they are both massive particles. So during this phase, the ratio of inflaton. So basically, here you have inflaton and on-shell particles, And then suddenly at this point,
during inflation, maybe I don't understand. What does T inflation mean? Does it mean when inflation
happens? Yeah, I shouldn't call it T inflation.
Temperature during inflation.
Yeah, I think temperature is not a good thing to put here. So I think actually probably this is where you want to start everything. So the idea is that you have your inflaton, and at some point it decays into radiation and dark matter, right?
And you're starting there.
That's where you want to start, exactly. That's where you want to start. Now, exactly, for inflation predictions, it does actually matter when inflation ends and when reheating starts. But I think actually this is knowing reheat temperature is almost all you need. I think you also need a little bit to know about how expansion works between the end of inflation and beginning of reheating. I think we assume it looks like
there's
a little period. And that little period matters because it affects a bunch of things that I'm going to come back. But you don't want to call it T inflation, but there is a time at which, well, I guess I could put it there.
T end.
But for this argument, it doesn't matter. So the idea is that at some point, your inflaton is going to decay into off-shell particles and dark matter, and the ratio is given by that formula. But also that ratio is T reheat divided by T equal.
So say that again. So your inflaton is going to
decay.
That's right. And it's
going to produce. It's going to produce some off-shell particles, which would be your.
This model.
That's in this model, yeah.
Okay, because the standard.
In a standard model, the same thing would happen. It wouldn't be necessarily dark matter. Dark matter could be produced later or at this time as well. But the point is.
Not be this off-shell thing, right? I mean,
that's right.
Nature has got specifically to do with
that's right. It wouldn't be off. So this equation wouldn't be there in a regular.
So right. So
but this would be there.
No.
F would be something else.
Something else not dependent on lambda. Right?
Yeah. I mean F either you would produce dark matter at some point in radiation era, so you wouldn't have any coupling. If you produce dark matter at the end of inflation, then F is whatever your process depends on the process that produces dark matter. I guess there are
The point is somehow that you can distinguish this feature, which is the off-shell feature,
mm-hmm.
from this.
Right. So this is the key equation that because here, if you think lambda is in Planck, this you have a very, very specific number here, which fixes the reheating temperature. And reheating temperature is important because, as I'm showing here, it's the main uncertainty in inflationary predictions. So this is a plot you typically see in cosmology papers, for example, Planck papers that constrain inflation. This is a spectral index, and this is the tensor to scale ratio. This is the amplitude of gravitational waves, primordial gravitational waves to sound waves, basically. And then this is the tilt, or the color of the spectrum of perturbations. And the gray region is 1 and 2 sigma region. This is from Planck 2015, I believe. And these are a few different inflationary models. I think we have MS squared, phi squared.
What's the difference between the left hand?
Right. So what I'm showing on the left hand side, there are two particular models. I think there's I think this is I think this was a natural inflation. It could be any one of these, I guess it doesn't matter. It's one of these inflationary models. Then what you see there's a region there. So if you fix the temperature of reheating, then it gives you a line here. But then because we don't know temperature of reheating, so temperature of reheating could be anything between 10 to the 15 GeV and 1 mega electron volt, roughly speaking, 1.4 mega electron. So it's a huge range. That's this T reheat that I was talking about. It could have a huge range. That changes the number of E foldings of inflation, basically something between 30 to 60. So the bigger the reheating temperature, the more E foldings of inflation you need, basically. And the way to think about it is just that basically you need to counteract. What inflation does is counteracts the expansion during the radiation era. During the radiation era, the horizon is shrinking. The horizon is expanding, and you need to shrink it. So the longer the radiation era lasts, the more inflation you need to kind of cancel it. and the larger the reheating temperature, the more refolding the inflation. So that's why you get basically this big range. So this is for R squared inflation, which is the first model inflation by Stravinsky. And this is, I think, either for natural inflation or one of these other inflation models. And the point of this plot is that it shows that now, if you use Mathis' result for dark matter to radiation ratio that fixes reheating temperature, it makes a very small sliver of it. So it makes the inflation predictions much more precise. You still have to pick your inflation model, but your predictions will be much more precise.
Inflation equations themselves, though, are local equations.
Yes.
So this way of introducing non-locality kind of seems to me somehow, if I were to do, I'm not saying anyone should do it, but it's a hard problem, but if you were to go back to those equations and try to do it for a fully non-local theory, it looks like the specifics, you know, in the momentum space, the way in which the equation would potentially modify.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
That you wouldn't even get anything. I mean, so, but okay, so that's...
No, but that's a good point. But you could ask, I mean, the inflation scale is much lower than Planck scale. So you could ask, what are the quantum gravity corrections to inflation? Just at the level of effective field theory. Because I mean, the analogy between this approach and effective field theory is, I mean, there's a close analogy because everything is suppressed by powers of the cutoff. And if your cutoff is M Planck, you would think all the corrections would go as M over M Planck. So,
I guess the point is that those equations are really essential in predicting perturbations of CMB and so on. But now your approach is to say, well, let's say that all of that is the case, but that this F, factor of F, is the one that's coming from non-locality. We're not entirely sure. And so it's phenomenological. I just want to understand where one is making the...
Yeah. No, I think it's a good point. The idea is that you can ignore a small effects unless they somehow blow up in your face. And I think just for inflationary dynamics, I think this is going to be a small effect, like 10 to the minus, M phi is like 10 to the 13 GeV usually, and Planck is 10 to the 18, so it would be 10 to the minus 10 correction. But it does blow up in your face at the end when, if you say there's a tiny amount that go into these non-local modes, but eventually they come to dominant universe, right? So this is a tiny effect during inflation, but it does grow over time, and it eventually dominates the universe. So I think it's justified to do this, actually, because I mean for inflation trajectories, it's a tiny correction, but this tiny amount eventually builds up over time and gives us dark matter. So I think it's reasonable approximation. Does that make sense? So I'm saying your trajectories get tiny corrections, but those tiny corrections eventually secularly grow at very late times and give us dark matter.
So, but the question is also that in the inflationary mechanism itself.
But I'm saying that those are...
Whether those perturbations, the nature of those perturbations, you're saying it doesn't matter.
There is
a non-local equation. You're giving an argument why...
There are corrections go as Q to the fourth divided by lambda. So during inflation, Q would be your Hubble, roughly.
Okay.
So
you're saying it wouldn't actually affect the field, the non-locality of the field equations. Then.
Not significantly. I mean, at least because this correction would be small, unless there is a non-trivial or non-perturbative effect.
The nature of those equations is very important.
I mean, I think there is also this question of So could you have, if you have Planck scale?
The terms there in that equation. If you just took that equation and tried to modify it. I thought that there's a certain robustness to that equation, which
There are all these, I guess, people talk about swamp-Planck conjectures, like in quantum theories of gravity, could fields travel Planck length, for example. And I think people argue about that. It's not obvious that from effective field theory arguments, it's not clear anything wrong with that. But then, I mean, there are certain constructions. When people look for constructions of these, it looks like it's hard to come up with constructions that field travels Planck length. So I think that could be a connection there, but it's not.
Field travels.
Planck distance, I guess, in the field space. Yeah, so the question is, can a scalar field travel a distance larger than Planck energy?
Well, can a scalar field
be super Planckian? Yeah.
And its natural units have its strength, which is above the Planckian.
Or travel longer than it.
That distance, more than.
That's right. So there is a there has been a controversy, and some
field strengths change by more than a unit. Planck units.
That's right. And I mean, it naively thinks that it should be wrong because, I mean, quantum gravity should be important on Planck if you change, you have Planck energy in some sense. Except that these the energy scales are all very sub-Planckian. It's just the distances. So it's I think it's somewhat model dependent. It's not clear anything. Obviously, it goes wrong with inflation because here you do not putting the field here. You put the Q, which is your momentum scale. And momentum scale is very sub-Planckian during inflation.
Are you thinking that this particle is the inflaton?
Yeah, the field is an inflaton. That's the idea.
That non-local field must be the inflaton.
That's right.
For this to work.
Yeah, that's right. That's the main idea, is that the particle that's decaying is the inflaton, and it would decay to some off-shell mode and some on-shell mode.
So I guess Timothy is asking, would its dynamics during the inflationary era be affected?
Right. That's right, exactly. That's what she's asking. I'm saying that the effect would be a small.
Because of this smallness.
Yeah, I mean, if you just look at this, then what it suggests is that your field equation, which is something like this. I have another board here, right? So like inflationary field equation is something like this, for example, right? So if you have that non-local effect, then maybe you expect that there will be like a phi, four derivatives of phi divided by lambda squared terms of this type might appear, right? So this would be, I'm just replacing my box with the higher derivative thing. But then the idea is that these are suppressed by powers of H, right? So I should remember how there are also powers of epsilon that come in.
Lambda, right?
So yeah, this is lambda.
Okay, so all of them are suppressed by lambda.
Yeah. So basically, the idea would be that this is of order h squared. This is of order, I think, epsilon h squared. This would be epsilon h to the fourth divided by lambda squared.
I guess if there's a scale, the spatial scale of.
Mm-hmm. Probably epsilon squared, I would think. Right.
If it's comparable to, if it's at the time of whatever.
Yeah.
In time, then of course it'll be modified.
But that's
the
right.
The thing is that there'll be modifications, but as long as, you know, it arrives at some semi-classical scale.
That's right, yeah. And in fact, what we know is
from this non-locality scale, it'll be.
From amplitude of gravitational waves, I mean, it's supposed to be h squared over m Planck squared.
So then isn't it true that transplanckian effects or, you know, things like that, they do matter? So very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have effects at the level of the non-locality scale, then inflation is going to make them relevant.
I think that's the point of controversy. You see that?
Okay.
In a Lorentz invariant framework, it's not clear whether transplanckian effect matters. If you violate.
I just mean transplanckian in the sense of the fact that the scale now that we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
at which the equations get
right.
modified, so the nature of the modes get modified at the scale of the non-locality scale, which is larger than Planck,
mm-hmm.
presumably. Then.
But here we are assuming it's Planck.
That'll have an effect on. On the modes that you see in the sky.
If you assume it's Planck, then it's not clear whether there's an effect.
If you assume that it's, say, I don't know, 100 times Planck length or whatever.
Then it could be a big effect.
At scale, then it could affect.
It could affect things, absolutely.
Because, mm-hmm. It doesn't get stretched that much. Right?
Yeah. No, then you don't really trust the inflationary framework itself.
Right. So that's, I guess that's one of the questions, whether that non-locality, if the non-locality.
Oh, we are already over time. So let me just wrap up then. So Okay, so I think that the other questions, I think in terms of sharpening inflation prediction is nice, but I mean, who knows what's the right inflation model? So maybe that's not going to be a very, very predictive test at the end. Another thing we can actually do is to look at the free streaming of dark matter, because now dark matter has a very different way of production. It's not a thermal production. It's through this decay of inflaton. And it doesn't have a single mass. It has a range of masses. So then you could ask basically how far does it travel? Because so dark matter from where it's produced, it could have different masses and different initial momenta, and then it would travel different distances. Why do we care? So that's the kind of the distribution of distances that you get from distribution of masses and initial conditions. And it depends on the reheating temperature. Now, why do you care about how far the dark matter travels? The reason is that it actually affects the power spectrum of dark matter on a small scale, because that's what it does is this free streaming cuts off the distribution of power spectrum of dark matter. You might have some scale invariant spectrum, but then if dark matter travels, it's going to wipe out all the structure below the scale of free streaming. So this is actually then a prediction for what's called as a transfer function, which is proportional, a square of this with the power spectrum of dark matter. So this is the small scales, this is larger scales. For a scale invariant model, you basically get a constant. You get this fall off from free streaming, which does depend on reheat temperature. But then what you get is you get this plateau, and this plateau has to do with this early dark matter dominated era, which is basically from the time that inflation ends to the time of reheating, there will be some period in which you have an early matter-dominated era, basically. And that causes mode to grow during that time. So this is a very characteristic prediction for the power system of dark matter. So typical dark matter models, there will be just a constant, you would have a fall-off because of free streaming. And then here we have this plateau, which is, and there is one free parameter that controls everything. So how can we test this? This is a plot which from a recent paper that compiles. These are all future, with the exception of the CMB and then the QSO. Everything are future projected measures. Actually, no, FireEyes is also FireEyes and future. Yeah. So these are limits on the dark matter power spectrum. So this is basically related to the square of this transfer function. So in a standard inflation and with minimal dark matter model, this should be just a flat with a slight tilt, flat power spectrum with a slight tilt. We only observe it here. There is a measurement here. And there are some upper limits here. And where you see this interesting structure is around a parsec to 10 to the 3 parsec inverse. In the units that are shown here would be 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 9, which is right around here. And the limit we have from quasars, and some of you might have heard about this if you've been to the group meetings, is from observing the light curves of a standardized quasar, is from work with Mansour and Jesus Zavala, who are both here. We actually have an upper limit. We don't have a detection of this yet, but we are starting to probe this region. And in principle, basically, if we have the data gets much better and our calibration of method gets much better, we could see a feature that looks like this, right? A step of this sort, if we start to actually detect the dark matter down here and measure its shape. We are not there yet, but it's something that is in principle. So let me wrap up. So these are kind of, there are a bunch of open questions. As I mentioned, coupling to gauge theories and fermions, gravitational coupling is different, or is gravitational coupling different? So the question is, yeah, I mean, do you just use energy momentum tensor? Because we didn't really do much with gravity in this non-local action. Maybe we should actually put G mu nu inside the non-local box, and then would be weird things that might happen, who knows. Could there be some type of coherent interactions like gravity that we could use to detect dark matter, even though its scattering doesn't work? There could be other possible tests, and then non-inflation big grand model. So these are all kind of things to think about to further this particular program. Okay, thanks everyone. Any questions?
Yeah,
Yes.
Yeah, just if you could just go back to the last question.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're saying that in the way that you you know, in the way you incorporate it into inflation.
Yes.
This putting in a particular form for F, you're saying would give you a better idea of the
reheating. That's right. Yeah.
But could you not simply then, is there no way of saying it comes just from some one of the thousands of inflationary models? I mean, would it distinguish, or would it simply, would it be a way to say, okay, it's consistent? Or is that, I mean, that's what,
yeah,
that's what this test would be, right? So you know, it's not it's a consistency check, or is it a test? That's what I'm not entirely
sure. I mean, could you... would you rule out, you're saying, is there an inflation? You see, the thing about inflation is that it can predict anything. So whatever nice predictive theory you have, there is always an inflation theory that predicts exact same thing, right?
Okay.
So there is no way that you could win against inflation, right? But
so you're saying that, okay, so, so then I understand.
So I think that the name of the game is if you survive, then you've won. If you, yeah, but you can never beat inflation. Right.
You can rule out individual inflationary models.
You can rule out, that's right. That's
said, this gives you a handle. I mean, if you believe this, you can rule out more than
that's right.
Currently ruled out.
Yeah.
Any popular ones that are ruled out by this logic?
Well, it's so the one that the most popular, I guess, there is one inflationary model, which is it's very popular because it's just, it's the first one, Stravinsky's model, and it's kind of right in the middle of that preferred by Planck, and it looks like it's not ruled out, right? So you see, there's this a sliver that becomes this tiny dot, and it's still within, so it's still not ruled out. You could talk about these other ones, but I don't know which one is more popular. This depends on your. So they are, I mean, some of them are kind of more restricted. So I kind of like probably the green one wouldn't have fallen out of the two sigma, but it's now outside the two sigma. The green being, I guess.
Conversely, can you put a bound on lambda?
Yeah, so here we assume lambda is this between 0.1 to 1 in Planck, and that's why this is not a line. This has a width. Yes, you could do that. But then, of course, then they have uncertainty in inflation model and uncertainty in lambda. So, yeah, it's a bit.
No, but what I mean is that if you wanted this to come from, I mean, if we say, that we want it to come from a non-locality scale.
Yeah. If you somehow fix your inflation model, then you could use this to bound lambda.
Well, if you fix the inflation, okay.
Yeah, you have to fix.
Two answers. Yeah, I understand.
So that's why I'm hoping something like this will.
In the map, then there's the inflation model and there's lambda ranges that are possible.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if one did that sort of matching. How large can those lambda values be?
Yeah, I mean, you could already see this here. So lambda is, this is 0.1 to 1 M Planck. And I don't remember which way actually it would go. If you increase lambda, would you go this way or this way? But yeah, there's a one-to-one mapping between which line you look at and which lambda. So yeah, but yeah.
It has to be around this.
No, if you make it the range of lambda bigger, then of course the orange region would become bigger as well. But there might be an upper limit that comes, but again, that would depend on your inflation model. So different inflation models.
But I mean, the question is how big can it? I mean, it's a curious thing because that's something that we would like to also constrain in some way.
Yeah.
So what are the things? So for example, if you had a very, very large non-locality scale,
yeah, still
very small compared to any lab observable thing, and you take it into your these inflationary models, then you will have a constraint because otherwise you'll get maybe you'll get structure formation that looks
But I mean you have to believe your inflationary model, that's the thing.
Right.
So yeah,
you know what that potential is, that's what
Yeah.
Right, but it'll give you what I'm saying is that it'll give you for every V of phi, it'll give you a range of acceptable non-locality scales, and it would just be curious to know if there are any.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. I can look at that and I can get back to you on that. But yeah, I don't know it off the top of my head. I don't think it's going to be terribly interesting because everything moves like very little. So I don't remember which way. I mean, would you, if you say you have to be within the Planck region, like for example, Stravinsky's model, would that give you interesting range in lambda? Okay, I should get back to you on that. Thanks. Other questions? If not, then let's break off.
Speaker.
Yes. That's enough. You don't have to, but that's okay. Thanks.